Crime Curious is a true crime podcast that takes an in-depth look into real cases through the lens of a trained investigator and former prosecutor turned judge.
If you are sensitive to expletives, anatomical descriptions, and accurate descriptions of crime scenes, this podcast may not be suitable for you.
Welcome to Crime Curious. I'm Charnel.
I'm Megan.
Let's shake all of our gree-gree, Megan.
I'm two-fist in it.
I see that. All right. How's everybody doing today? I want to start off with saying thank you to a sweet listener left us a nice review, but they mentioned that they have a hard time hearing me. So thank you for letting us know that. I've adjusted the mic settings, but I do want to give, if this was your review, I want to give some advice in that try different platforms and see if that works, because I know that podcasts sound different from Apple Podcasts to Spotify to the Patreon app.
Yeah, even. I love our Patreon app, but there are certain podcasts where I have my volume all the way up. Mm-hmm. So I listen to us in the shower and I will have to potentially turn my volume all the way up, but then sometimes I get into an enclosed area for a different podcast or us and I have to turn it down quite a bit so I don't, you know, blast out my eardrum. So.
Yeah, she said she had a hard time listening in the car as well. So hopefully between the advice of trying different platforms and I have adjusted the microphone settings, I hope everyone can hear me now.
And that, my friends, is what we called constructive criticism.
It was beautiful. Yeah. Yes, thank
you. We'll take it. I
won't make fun of you. I won't write a poem or anything.
No, it was useful. Thank you. So are you ready for a deep divey today?
Yeah.
When I say deep divey, I mean that I read a book. It's not going to be something that I will turn into two parts because I want people to read her book. And the reason is because I just can't do it justice to relay for you what it must have been like to be, this is a victim who is a survivor, but was a victim of sex trafficking from a very early age.
Okay.
And she just writes her memoir so beautifully. But it's powerful. I'm going to warn you ahead of time. It is powerful. There's a lot of details, not all of which I am putting into this episode because some of it is just far too explicit, even with our explicit
warning.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
And so, but she really does take the reader into, I think, as close as you can become to being a victim without actually being a victim. I mean, it's powerful. So I read that, very, very much enjoyed it. As much as someone can enjoy a book about sex trafficking, but it was so enlightening. And I'm bringing you the major, you know, points here and bringing you the case, but grab her memoir. It is called I Cried to Dream Again, Trafficking, Murder, and Deliverance. And the victim's name is Sarah Cruzen. She wrote this with author Corey Thomas. So pick it up. It's in the show notes as well.
Can I say at least I'm happy you're giving me a survivor?
Yeah, it's been a while, I feel like, since we've had a survivor case. It is still a murder case.
Okay.
There is murder. There is a lot of victimization. But at the end of it, there is a true survivor.
All right.
So let me tell you a little bit about Sarah Cruzen. She was born January 8th, 1978. She was raised by her mother in Riverside, California, where she was an honor roll student at school during her early years in elementary and whatnot. During her childhood, she met her father, her biological father, only three times because he was in and out of prison a lot. Her childhood was rife with abuse on all forms, Megan, from physical, emotion, mental, and of course, sexual.
Mom's boyfriends.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yep. Her mother had admitted to bashing Sarah's head on the floor on different occasions. When I talk about physical abuse, Child Protective Services did come into play because there was proof of this physical abuse and she was in and out of foster care.
All right.
Okay.
So we have substantiated child abuse with multiple removals.
Yep. Sarah will say that she was molested for the first time at age 5 by her mom's boyfriend. And the reason I started that sentence with Sarah will say is because that's what she can remember. We don't know. It very likely may have even been before then. I'm not sure. But earliest memories are typically around age 4 or 5 years old. And she definitely remembers that.
And when we interview survivors, especially young ones, we always ask them, tell me about the first time that you can remember. Tell me about the last time and tell me about the worst time. Mm-hmm. And they're usually different occasions.
Absolutely.
This is when you know you have multiple events of CSC.
Yep. Of course, as you have already touched upon, successive boyfriends did the same. She was continuously molested by mom's frequent boyfriends in and out of the house. This results in Sarah experiencing severe depression. She had numerous hospitalizations throughout her childhood. That's no surprise to you or I, or probably to our longtime listeners, who I feel like we have really taught a lot about this kind of abuse and the repercussions of it throughout our podcast. The family dynamic that she was raised with is that women are for men's pleasure, okay? If you give them that, Megan, if you satisfy a man sexually, then he's going to buy you things. He's going to give you money. He's going to take care of you. So either way, all men only want women for one thing, and if you give them that, they will be happy, and then you will be happy. This is a dynamic that was passed on to her, generationally from her mother. It was conversations that were had. Not only that, but it was reinforced by the men that were trying to justify their abuse of her as well. So she has it coming from all angles of, oh, this just must be my place in the world as a female.
Right. I'm here to give men pleasure. Mm-hmm. And then in return, my mom can pay rent.
Yes.
That's what I'm seeing my mom do.
Yes. Yeah. And if a man marries you, then he is investing in you. And it is your job as a woman to remain pretty, to smell good, to make sure that he's satisfied so that he will keep taking care of you financially.
I'm sorry. I just threw up in my mouth.
Oh, so bad. I'm telling you, this is me just paraphrasing her writing in her memoir is so beautiful. It really, really reaches people on, like me anyway, I had a visceral reaction.
Unfortunately, I've specifically heard this exact explanation in multiple cases over my career.
Yep, not unusual. And as I said, the other thing, like the marrying, the taking care of you financially, if you make me happy, then I get to make you happy. All of this stuff truly was just constantly reinforced. You know, it just seemed as though in her earliest years and then up through her teenage years, there was never that good, solid male figure or friend or even female figure that could stand up and say, no, this is not the norm. This is not okay. This is what she was surrounded by her entire earliest, you know, childhood and into her teen years. When Sarah was 11 years old, she lived in Rubidoux, California with her mother. They lived in a 2-room, rundown house, and her mother could barely take care of herself, let alone a child too. The neighborhood was really rough. There was a lot of gang violence, a lot of drug activity. It was nothing to hear gunshots outside her door. The house smelled of cat pee and cigarettes. Her mom did not clean the house. She often had it at 11 years old. It was her responsibility to clean the house, do any laundry of her own that she wanted done, dishes, things like that. Well, one day she was walking home from school when a bright, shiny red Mustang pulled up next to her. The man inside rolled down his window and politely asked her to come over to the car. She's not used to polite, right? First of all, okay? She's not used to shiny red Mustangs either.
No, she's used to mom's boyfriend beating her.
Absolutely. This man's name was George Gilbert, or as I'm going to refer to him for the remainder of the case, G.G. Howard.
G.G. Howard.
G.G. Howard. As a matter of fact, he was so well known as G.G. that it took long into her getting her much older teenage years before she even realized that he had that his name was George Gilbert. Okay.
That puts me right in her head, because that is such an adolescent memory to not know somebody's full name, because yeah. you know them so well by an acronym or a nickname.
Oh, absolutely. I was a full grown adult probably only about 10 years ago that I realized my great grandmother's name was not Gaga.
Right.
That's what her grandchildren called her. Her name was Dorothy.
Right.
I mean, why didn't it dawn on me until I was, I don't know, 28 years old to figure out that her Gaga is not a real name?
Yeah. It's a true thing.
You don't.
Yep.
You know, I grew up with her being Gaga.
Yep. I called my grandpa Poppy, and I had no idea that his name was John, other than that sometimes my grandma would call him Jack, but it was usually followed up by ass. So you didn't.
Right, yeah, it's even more confusing. I didn't know
his name was either Poppy or Jackass. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So this man, G.G. Howard, he was 20 years older than Sarah, who is 11.
Okay. Okay.
All right. So he's 31 years old.
Right. Stopping to.
An 11-year-old.
Talk to an 11-year-old. Mm-hmm.
He told her that he was going to go to the park and get some ice cream and asked if she would like to join. Of course she wanted ice cream. She is 11. And this is somebody being nice to her, possibly for the first freaking time in her life.
She hasn't been taught to avoid strangers.
Hell no. Or avoid strange men.
No.
Definitely not.
She's already been abused for at least 6 years of her life that she can recall. Exactly. Sexually.
Exactly. So she gets into the leather-seated front seat. She's taking in the luxury all around her. She does recognize that this feels weird, right? Like it first of all, it feels weird because it smells good in there. He smells good. She's not used to that. Her senses are on overload here. Like this is all, the leather is soft. Everything looks so luxurious. This seems just kind of odd. But she's too young to recognize that when someone, a grown-ass man, is being so kind to a young lady, that he's grooming her.
Right.
With tenderness. He also has very likely been watching her routine throughout the neighborhood long before this first moment when he actually spoke to her, to have known when she would have been walking home from school. So they go and get ice cream. They go to the park, just like he said, and then he takes her back to one of his three homes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He actually owns a legit limousine business, and there is some nefarious businesses on the side, of course, that we're going to get to,
yeah,
but he's a businessman.
Using his limo to pick up young girls to deliver them to his customers.
Oh, he's a pimp. He is a big, big pimp.
Also known as a trafficker.
Yep. Yep, exactly. But this is, well, I told you the year she was born, right?
1976.
Yeah, so we are 1978 and she's 11 yes. years old, right? We are in the early 90s here. And so I can just like see it all so clearly.
And, yeah, he's in the sports car and they got a little Ace of Base, All That She mm-hmm. Wants playing on the stereo.
Yep.
I'm the same age as this girl.
Well, that's funny that you mentioned that, because she does mention in the book that the neighborhood that she lived in, her mom, who is white, by the way, but her dad is black. So she had this, she was gorgeous. I mean, she still is, by the way, she's gorgeous, but she has this beautiful skin tone. She has this beautiful hair. Like she was eye-catching.
This
even
guy
at 11.
Was keeping an eye on her.
Absolutely.
He was watching her, just waiting to pounce.
Yep. But she mentions in the book that the type of music that was often played from the boom boxes in the rough neighborhood and whatnot, it's laughable to us now, but it was, her mom considered it inappropriate rap music. She used a racial slang for what type of music she thought it was. Okay. But, you know, I'm like thinking back to like Beastie Boys and yeah. Dr. Dre and like stuff like that. And that's what is being blasted and just acting like it's so wrong and naughty, right? So they go back to his house, and this is like a house she's never seen before. It's clean, smells really good.
Nice neighborhood.
So nice. Has expensive items in it, like provocative sculptures, shiny things. It's the early 90s. Remember, you know those lady silhouette sculptures, yeah. like
the naked ladies.
Yeah. Without being too sexual, but you can tell that they're provocative. That kind of motif. is what's going on up in here. So Gigi invited her to stay in the living room while he got cleaned up. So he went and showered and changed and put on more cologne. When he came back into the room, she describes how he took the liberty of tracing the outline of her body with both of his hands without ever touching her. So just like on her silhouette, right?
I can visualize it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he's saying very kind things, right? While he's doing that, he's gauging her reaction. This is the beginning of the grooming. Well, the beginning of the grooming was taking her for ice cream.
Right.
But this is the beginning of how I groom you so that you're not as scared of my touch, right? Right. So then he gently, like, reaches around and just starts to caress her bottom. When she doesn't freak out and overly react to that, keep in mind, this is not new territory for her, unfortunately. He gently removes her romper. And then he goes to her front. And she knows at this point that it's not okay. That he's an adult. She's a child. But her previous experiences of sexual abuse, which had been painful and scary, I might note, this one was not. So she doesn't know what to do in this situation. Whatever she had done previous to this had not been, there was no grooming.
Right.
It was just absolute use and abuse.
This is why we have to be careful when we ask kids questions about, like, did he hurt you?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes he doesn't. And your body, even when you're young, can have a nice, pleasant reaction even to a crime that's occurring to you.
Yes.
It may not have hurt.
Yep.
She may not have felt scared. She might have felt, like, weird.
She did. And she describes that.
Not necessarily hurt or scared.
Right. She actually does a great job of describing this incident, which resulted in him digitally penetrating her. Okay.
Okay.
And she is very forthcoming in the book and says, listen, it didn't hurt. My body responded. I didn't like that my body was responding.
No.
But it didn't feel like the abuse that she had been used to, because it wasn't physically painful. It wasn't one of mom's boyfriends, right? So that's what I want all of our listeners to understand, is that a savvy abuser will make sure that the victim feels comfortable and taken care of so that their abuse can continue with less chance of the victim telling someone. And that's exactly what happens here. Now, they get to a point, he does this grooming for a long time, years. Okay, like they end up with many years long relationship, but it starts with just those things. She described in the book how after, that's all he did that night. I don't want to say that's all, as if that's not bad enough, but you know what I'm saying. It went no farther. And then he took her home. She walked in. She remembers just having the smell of like the cat pee and the dirty dishes and the way that her mom was just sitting on her bed watching some trash TV, eating popcorn. And she vividly remembers her mom constantly just eating popcorn and like licking her fingers. You know, there's those little pieces that really stick and create core yeah. memories for you after times of abuse. And she was so terrified that her mom was going to know that she did something, as if she did
something wrong.
Yes, exactly. As if it had been her fault and she would be blamed for it, right? So that didn't happen. Mom can't even take care of herself. She's not paying attention to her daughter.
None.
She has no idea. So nor do, frankly, does she care, no. I think, in my opinion. But anyway, so Gigi Howard kind of serves as like a surrogate father to her for a while. He gives her gifts. He buys her, you know, things like the ice cream. The unaccustomed attention from a male that she's never had, he gives to her. He's nice, right? It made her feel noticed and important. And because on the outside he was being so nice, it's just such a contradiction to what she was used to males in her life being. His sexual abuse of Sarah becomes a regular part of her life, which led her into being forced into child sex trafficking, which she describes started at the age of 13. So he spent a couple of years just grooming her, abusing him herself, before then starting to actually traffic her out.
Okay. So he's using her for his sexual gratification from ages 11 to 13, and then it's going to escalate from there.
Yes, and he introduced her to his other houses that he had. He had a full-on brothel going on, but it was disguised as just rooms to rent for women, and they're, I mean, right with a madam. There was a madam of the house who made sure that the house, you know, was taken care of and that the girls were treating the customers as they should be. And he exposed her to that before training her, essentially. She describes how she kind of went through this in training process, essentially. And it wasn't just him. Not just her. It is his girls, as he would refer to these women as.
Were his girls, other of them, also underage?
All various ages. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the house, I mentioned that the house was run by a madam. She was a 38-year-old woman, although Sarah describes how he, later when she found out that Big Mama was only 38 years old, she was shocked because she looked a lot older than that. But everybody just called her Big Mama. Not at all motherly or right. nurturing. Okay, she ran a tight ship. She was getting a cut of this brothel. She was herself was a former sex worker, and anyone in those houses didn't bat an eye when a child walked through the doors to be trained or to go to a customer.
Wow.
Okay. Just absolute whole different world, I think, than I would hope than most of us are not accustomed to.
And we're in what area of California are his, like,
Rubidoux?
Right. Where are his houses and stuff? Are they spread out?
All through. No, they're like Riverside County.
Okay.
Yeah. And in a little beyond. We'll kind of get to that.
Okay.
But. So obviously Gigi is trafficking her. He would often pretend as if he were doing her a service instead of the other way around. He was strict. He made it very clear that he wanted his girls to always look their best, so much so that when he picked one up, he would give them a hard look up and down from head to toe, making sure that every detail looked presentable before even allowing the girls into his many different luxury vehicles that he had. As I mentioned, this is the early 90s for reference. And remember, this only solidifies the worldview that she had already been taught from an early age to look pretty, smell pretty, and satisfy a man, and he'll take care of you.
Right. She fell right into this mm-hmm. with him. She was the perfect victim already because of her early childhood abuse and trauma.
Yep. And as I mentioned, Gigi had a legitimate limousine business, okay? He had a lot of money. He believed himself to have a lot of power and to be a stud. He was 6'4". He had that false sense of masculine power. You know, he walked around with an air, a powerful air about himself.
And apparently he wasn't beating his girls. He was treating them well. And so he was doing them a favor, getting them off the streets, right?
Isn't that amazing how that works, yeah. right? Yes, I'm such a good...
I gave you a good life.
I'm practically a 501c charitable...
Realistically, yes. He's running a Cali nonprofit.
Yes, that's what he thinks. That's what he'll delude himself and others to believe. Gigi himself, though, would often drink heavily and force Sarah into hours-long sexual abuse. She knew his tells. This is why I want people to read this book, too, because the way that she describes some of the things that I don't think the average person would ever think of, okay? For example, this is a gruesome detail. But I think that it's important to kind of showcase how these are things that you unless you put yourself in that position, you just wouldn't think of. But she describes the way that a man releases a pheromone, a smell, just before an orgasm, and that she got to the point where she was so trafficked, she was able to recognize that smell as a cue about what's about to happen. Okay. And I just feel like this should reiterate to all of us of how frequently she was forced to engage in this type of abuse for her senses to be able to pick up and recognize that. She also...
She might have just developed an awareness from her sexual abuse that some people who have been married for 20-some years have never been able to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
She's that acutely mm-hmm. aware of the act that she's engaged in.
Yes. She described in the book how when she was 12... A 24-year-old man told her that he loved her while he was orgasming on her face. That was the first time she had ever been told by a man that he loved her.
Well, we know what his sick fucking fantasy is.
Right. Yep. These are her preteen experiences.
But that's her first I love you.
Yes. By someone of the opposite sex.
During a sexual abuse incident with him ejaculating on her face.
Yes. Yep.
That is disgusting.
Absolutely. But this is what I mean. She is not afraid to give those details. That's what I mean by she just really brings us into the story of, I got a little handsy here, of the, you know, the story of what it was like.
Keep going.
I know. It's difficult. And there were parts that were difficult for me to read because it exposes the darkest parts of human nature. And my brain and body, as I said earlier, were having this like visceral reaction. But her words carry a weight that only someone who's been through these experiences can hold.
These particular descriptions, in terms of a visceral reaction, they make me feel ragey.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't get disgusted or even like I need to turn off or emotionally separate. These type of situations make there be a ball in the pit of my stomach and I feel ragey. Like I want to find Gigi and get myself in trouble.
Don't worry. You can talk to Gigi's spirit if you'd like to.
Great.
Gigi is probably still in some sort of purgatory somewhere.
Okay.
When Sarah was 16 years old, her mother still lived in Rubidoux there, and she went to live with her grandmother in San Diego at this point in time. She actually tells a story in the book about how she lost someone close with her, a friend that was close to her. Okay, so she's kind of in this vulnerable place. And she went to a party, and she began to date a boy named Johnny Otis. Johnny was really, really nice to her. First of all, he's her same age. So this felt right. This felt normal. And for a short...
Her first normal adolescent relationship.
Yes. Yep. At 16. And she describes how, you know, it just... She could feel the difference between interactions with a young man her age and those abusive, grotesque men, adult men who had no business saying any compliments to her, right? Or anything.
She was able to experience her first consensual sexual experiences or romantic experiences if there wasn't anything sexual.
Yes. And I don't know. We're not going to fall in love with Johnny. I'll just say right off the bat, we're not going to fall in love with Johnny.
Great.
But why she was able to, I think, even consider this is because, God dang, this feels normal for once.
Yeah.
Right? He's my age. This is awesome. But unfortunately, Johnny had an uncle that had seen his fair share of prison time and hard lifestyle choices. And this man's name was James Earl Hampton. Now, unfortunately, James had learned all about Sarah's history with Gigi and who Gigi was. Gigi was pretty flashy. So it's not like people didn't know who Gigi Howard was, okay? So now he's got a connection to Gigi Howard. So he tells Sarah that he wants his money. I know the bastard's got all kinds of money. I want it, so I'm going to give you a choice. You can either kill Gigi and rob him, or else I'm going to kill you and your mom.
Wow.
So
there we go.
So which one's it going to be? Okay. What kind of choice is this for a 16-year-old girl who had literally been abused in every way possible her whole life and trusted no one? And I truly believe when you go through her childhood history, there is no reason for her to believe that this man is not going to make good on his promise. Okay? She's known nothing but terrible people. So, of course, when somebody gives her an ultimatum like this, she absolutely believes James Earl Hampton is going to kill my mother and myself.
Right. And whether you like it or not, she has an attachment to her mother.
Oh, of course. No matter what kind. Absolutely. We reiterate that all the time on this podcast as well. It does not matter what kind of parent they were. There is still that attachment many, many times. So I'm going to take you to March 9th, 1994. Sarah agrees to meet Gigi for a date and to spend the night with him at the Dynasty Suites Motel. It's a very common Gigi-esque motel that they go to.
Is she still working for him?
She is from time to time. Yeah.
Okay. But this time it was for him personally. He yes. wanted to have a date.
Yes. But you like how that's worded? Purposely. That's yes. how it was worded.
Air quotes. I'm dating
you. I'm 20 years older than you. You are 16, but we're dating. Mm-hmm. So Gigi picked her up at the movie theater. As usual, he scrutinized her from head to toe before allowing her into his cream-colored Jaguar. Sarah had a gun hidden in her purse, by the way, given to her by James Hampton.
Okay.
Not registered before anybody asks.
Oh, I didn't ever think it was a legal weapon. And she's 16.
Yes. They drove to the hotel. The sights and the smell of his car and cologne were all too familiar to her. In the hotel room, Gigi began mixing his usual drink, which was a sign for Sarah that he planned to engage in hours-long sexual activities. He had his tells. If he wasn't drinking, it wouldn't be as long. Okay? When he's drinking, it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes.
It is so awful that she even knows these cues about her abuser, but so typical.
Her observations were so astute. Yeah. Oh, my God. And the sexual hours-long sexual activities weren't going to only involve him, but various sex pleasure objects as well. In the room, she was actually forced. When they got to the room, they were not alone. The room was being occupied by another transaction that was being happening from one of Gigi's quote-unquote girls and a customer. So she describes how she had to sit there politely and watching as the painful thrusts took place, all while she was boiling inside. In these moments, she describes in her memoir how she began thinking of all the ways that every adult in her life had failed her, failed to protect her, abused her, shamed her, made her feel worthless. She contemplated using the gun on her purse on herself instead to escape this life. So she came that night in that hotel room to kill Gigi, but only because another adult in her life had ordered her to do it. Otherwise, she and her mother would be killed. So yet again, another way that an adult has used her and failed her in life. And she's just sitting there in this hotel room while this horrific thing is happening in front of her that she describes in detail. And in knowing that's about to be her next, right?
Right.
And her, and there's this gun in her purse that she's supposed to use all as a puppet from another violent person in her life. It's just so absolutely tragic. So by the early morning hours of March 10th, 1994, Sarah had endured enough. She describes how the size of Gigi's sex organ, okay, his penis, was extremely long and painful. Okay, so she talks about how he, not only is he abusing her, but the objects that he brought with him were equally as painful.
Okay.
So he orders her to undress and to get on the bed. And as he went to plug in one of the sex objects that he brought, she took her purse to the bed with her and she approached him quietly from behind with the gun in her hand. She put it right to his head and she pulled the trigger.
No hesitation.
No. There was a loud sound. She does say, though, she did think again about turning the gun on herself instead of him. In that moment, there was a loud sound, but to her surprise, only a small splatter of blood. So she's in shock now. She hurries. She takes $1,500 from his wallet and the keys to his Jaguar XJS, which is what was instructed of her to do by James Hampton. And in her shock and panic, she left her purse behind in the hotel room.
Oh, this girl.
And it did have her ID in it.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. After composing herself, she then went to meet boyfriend Johnny and his uncle James Hampton at a local supermarket that was pre-planned and gave him the car and the money. Okay, so for her, I'm safe now. Gigi's dead. My mom is safe. I'm safe.
just no thought of the consequences after, because she's in self-preservation. She's in survival mode.
Yes, absolutely. It didn't take long for Gigi Hauer's body to be discovered the next morning by hotel housekeeping staff, which, by the way, has to be a constant fear of hotel staff, the stuff that they must see. So if you are a hotel staff worker, thank you for what you do, because I bet every time you swipe one of those cards or unlock a door in any way, you're wondering what the hell's on the other side of it.
I agree.
When law enforcement officials at the scene found Sarah's identification card and purse left behind in the motel room, a warrant is issued for her arrest. March 14th, she was arrested at the home where James Hampton was residing, in Pomona, California. Okay. During questioning, Sarah confesses to the police, along with the entire story that I have detailed thus far. They do not call Sarah's mom in. Sarah does not have a lawyer. Sarah does not understand what the right to remain silent really meant.
Nope.
Okay?
In certain states, if you are under the age of 17 or 18, depending on what age you can be charged as an adult, you have to have a parent's permission to be questioned by law enforcement. Mm-hmm. That's how it is here.
She tried to tell them about James Hampton. The house, I mean, he was staying at the house that they found her at, for crying out loud. Like, this has to connect some dots, but they wouldn't listen. They kept interrupting her and insisting that she had acted on her own. They are simply looking at her as a prostitute and nothing more. They even lied to her, telling her that there was security footage outside the hotel room and that it showed only her and Gigi enter. Now, remember I told you that she had to watch others that night as well, right? In reality, this was a lie. There was no footage to be seen because it had already been recorded over by the time that they went to the hotel and asked to review it.
Yeah, they're in a loop.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that that Sarah didn't learn until the trial, until after she had confessed, because she didn't understand anything. She didn't understand that police wouldn't look at her as a 16-year-old abused child. Okay. She was young, and although there had been cops, this is so sad, that had been her, quote, clients.
Oh, Charnel.
You're not going to like this. Brace yourself, everybody. She tells a story of how one cop client had actually invited her to sit in his cop car while he was in uniform, and he paid her to perform oral sex on him. While on duty, in uniform, he paid with a $20 bill and a pubic hair, proof that he would not turn her in for her sex work.
Oh my God.
Right? Like, we're cool, man. I'm not, here's my DNA, whatever. Like, I'm not going to get you for this terrible work that you're being forced to do, by the way. Yeah.
No thought in her brain yet, because she's just been so abused and she's so young, but he's the one that has solicited a prostitute while on duty.
Of course not. No, she was young. This was when
he's,
I think,
telling
she was,
her, hey, I won't turn you in for your prostitution if you give me a blowy for 20 bucks.
Yeah. I believe she said she was 14.
Oh, and she was only 14 this that, time then?
Oh my God.
Engaged in, see, 16 is often the legal age of consent, by the way, for sexual activity, mm-hmm. but you can't consent to prostitution because it's illegal. And even though it happens all the time that people, you know, turn the blind eye to mm-hmm. legal adult prostitutes or sex workers.
Yeah.
But this child couldn't consent anyway.
No, not at all.
This is a law enforcement officer.
And this is only one story of many of professionals and
so she has this opinion of law enforcement, like, hey, they engage in this particular activity, they might believe me.
Yes. And also she mentions the only other experience that she had with law enforcement is from the TV show series Chips.
Oh.
Which is not at all what these law enforcement officers were going to be like. No. One of them even reminded her actually of her client. Okay. I almost wonder, was it your client? Like, we don't know that. But it just really, the dude really reminded her of him. So exactly like you said, she's thinking, okay, like, you know all about these things, so of course you're going to believe me.
Right.
Because You guys do this stuff too. She thought that they were maybe good guys that would see that she shot her pimp, and while he was sexually abusing her out of fear for her own life and from the abuse. It is not what happens, Megan. Not what happens. It's so...
They charge her as an adult?
They charge her as an adult. We're going to get to it. She was first taken to a juvenile place. Yep. Where she did really well, by the way. She really did. The district attorney of Riverside County opted to ignore the pleas for extenuating circumstances surrounding her actions and her history of abuse. He sought to have her tried in an adult court for first-degree murder. An evaluation by the California Youth Authority actually concluded that she was suitable for treatment in the juvenile justice system.
Yes.
However, a local judge, at the urging of the prosecutor, Tim Freer, transferred her to the adult court. This judge, by the way, that ends up overseeing her case is known as, he's got this, I forgot to make note of the name that she said in the book, but he had essentially a nickname for absolutely being a ball buster and like sentencing a lot of people to death. He just really was on a campaign of, I'm going to make an example out of a lot of people.
They didn't do assessments like they did then now either. Although it would be pertinent, I guess, to point out that there had been one with her where it indicated it was suitable to keep her in the juvenile justice system. You know, with automatic waiver or waiver cases. So this is how you charge a juvenile with an adult. Certain crimes, you don't have to petition the court, by the way, to charge them as an adult. They automatically waive mm-hmm. over to the adult system. Life offenses, for example, like murder. Okay. We won't get into the fact that there are others that you actually have to have a hearing and ask for permission for the court. But I want to point out what's really interesting is that when a juvenile is charged as an adult here and they go through the system and they're in the circuit courts, which is the highest felony court at a local level, the judge has the control for the sentence to still sentence them as a juvenile if they determine it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. So after a conviction, they can sentence them to a juvenile sentence instead of sending them to prison in an adult system.
Yep. That's not what happens here.
I didn't think it was going to, which is why I wanted to point it out that there's an option or a choice in terms of your judiciary, what they can do.
Well, and what was just so sad for me to hear is that she describes her attorney. Okay, first of all, at her arraignment, her public defender, you know, just they went through, she describes, and I can see it so perfectly for 1994. At her arraignment, she was never asked questions. She was never talked to. She was talked around and about.
Yeah.
Her attorney, she is sitting there at 16 years old, guys. She does not understand any of the language that's around her. Her public defender is not ensuring that she understands what's going on, anything. The judge and the prosecutor and her public defender are talking only, and they're deciding of whether or not she is going to be charged with first degree murder and what the, you know, what should happen to her. And she describes how she can't hear anything. She's sitting there in cuffs, both on her hands, shackled on her ankles. She does not even, I mean, she doesn't even have the attention span for all of this, let alone all the large words, right?
Right.
And the only thing that is said to her is her attorney looks over and says, right, Sarah? And she says, right.
Like being in a fog.
Yes.
And you just responded to the man.
Yep.
But you don't know what he's really asked you.
Right. And really what he was asking about is, you know, are these circumstances correct? That you murdered at point blank, you murdered this man? That you were engaging in sex work and sexual acts? With
that was like a plea.
That was that, like, do you agree? Yeah.
Did she plead or was there a trial?
No, there's a trial.
Okay.
But at the trial, and oh, by the way, I want to mention that a public defender mm-hmm. immediately excused himself from the case. He didn't want the case. So they had to issue another public defender for her actual trial. This man she speaks very highly of and says was very kind.
Okay.
All right. He was very gentle with her. He tried to help the best that he could, but he was absolutely no match for the bulldog prosecutor, who, by the way, is now a judge and was campaigning at the time to be a judge.
Okay.
So he had a mission. Okay. He had an agenda, none of this stuff is known to a 16-year-old, right? She doesn't know. Yeah. And so this this prosecutor here is Timothy Freer, by the way, is coming at her as just a cold-hearted murderer. They do not allow, unbeknownst to Sarah, as she is in the juvenile detention center awaiting her trial through all that time, does very well, no disciplinary actions. She's not a problem at all. She actually really thrived there. She doesn't know that they are actually arguing of whether or not all of her sexual abuse, her childhood history, and all of that can come into play at trial.
Okay.
They determine that it cannot. So before we get mad at the jury, we have to understand that the jury does not have any information aside from what the prosecutor paints as a prostitute that murdered her pimp.
Instead of a child that was sex trafficked who ended up murdering her abuser, so she wasn't killed.
Correct. First of all, you all should know, in the investigation, James Howard, Johnny Otis, never interviewed, never investigated, never any charges.
What?
They immediately decide, nope, you're lying. There's no connection here. She was found at the Hamptons' house, Mr. Hampton's house, right?
Yeah.
So, nope, but that's all you just lying. He didn't. Of course, they asked the question, like, this is what they're saying, but there was never any charge. Yep. Nope.
She killed him on her own.
Yep. Nope. I didn't tell her I was going to kill her and her mom. No.
Don't you feel like this girl had to have confided in her new boyfriend about the things that were going on in her life for him to know about this relationship with Gigi, with him trafficking her? And then he told his uncle from prison. And then the uncle was like, oh, have I got a plan for us?
Absolutely.
I'm going to get this girl to kill him, or I'm going to threaten her and her mom's life. I'm going to get his car. I'm going to get cash. Mm-hmm. Like, I can just picture the whole thing.
And I don't know enough about Johnny to know at 16, did he tell his uncle thinking, my uncle's a bad dude, he'll take care of this so that my girl will be safe? Like, he'll, who you know, knows? Right? Well, I don't know. And we'll never know, because these two men are...
They disappear.
Yeah, they're not a part of, they don't become a part of Sarah's case. They're not allowed to be mentioned.
But Sarah's story, her version, is that is what truly happened.
Yes, but their names are not allowed to be used in court at all for her defense. So her defense attorney has to take the stance of, she did not want to be trafficked anymore. So she didn't want to be forced into this anymore. So she murdered him, and it doesn't go well. And actually at her trial, Sarah is the only one who testifies on her defense.
So she took the stand.
She did. She said that she killed Gigi Howard because someone else had ordered it and threatened to kill her and her mother if she didn't carry out the orders. She's not allowed to say who it was.
Okay.
So as a result, her defense attorney, whose name was David Gunn, that's the nice guy that she speaks highly of in the book, told the court of information provided to the police by the alleged person who told her, you know, to kill the guy, right? It brings up the information that just... No, they're denying it. They're saying that they didn't say this, right? So the district attorney then brings forth motions not to charge Hampton or James Hampton or Johnny Otis. So they don't ever, regardless of what her stance is, they don't ever get charged ever. It's just so sad to me. Like, maybe not Johnny, he's 16 too, but like, what the hell, you know?
I have a lot of feelings.
I have feelings.
In his closing arguments at the trial, the prosecutor, Timothy Freer, cautioned jurors not to be swayed by the appearance of an attractive petite teenager who might not fit their image of a murderer. So you're bringing in her looks?
He said she was attractive.
He did.
He said a teenage girl was attractive.
Yes, he did. Thank you for picking up on that.
It's creepy, man.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Were you a patron?
I don't know. If I was a defense attorney, I'd be like, it is really not on trial today whether or not the prosecution thinks that my client is attractive.
Well, and you know why he wanted to reiterate that? Because she's a prostitute.
Right.
Willing prostitute. She's using her feminine woes.
16-year-olds. And that was her at her advanced age of 16. She'd been engaged in sex trafficking as a quote-unquote prostitute or sex worker for years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
She couldn't consent to any of those.
No.
And the victim in this case, the one that died, I will call him. I can't call him a victim, actually. It makes me feel a little nauseous.
Agreed.
He was the one trafficking her.
Well, the prosecutor...
There's just such mitigating circumstances that were never brought up.
Well, and the prosecutor uses that against her. Like, well, we can't ask Gigi, can we? Because he's not here because she murdered him. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. On May 11th, 1995, a Riverside Superior Court jury of 7 women and 5 men found her guilty of first-degree murder. Remember, none of them know about her sexual abuse history. None of them are connecting the dots that she's forced into sex trafficking. They believe that she entered into this as a 16-year-old girl on her own. And they affirmed two special circumstances, that Gigi was murdered during a robbery.
Why?
Because remember, she took his Jaguar and she took the $1,500.
But she gave them to somebody else. She didn't even have them.
But they claimed they never received it. They didn't know.
Where was the goddamn Jaguar then?
No idea. Who knows what that dude did with it?
She committed a robbery but left her own purse?
Thank you. Well, I mean, obviously you're a better attorney than these guys.
But so are you.
That's a good point.
You don't have a law degree.
Right, I do not. Yep. And they, so the two special circumstances are that Gigi was murdered during a robbery and that Sarah Cruzan had been lying in wait to kill him to justify a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. And that's what she got. At
is this
16.
Memoir written from prison?
No.
Okay. I'm like, please tell me this gets a little happier.
There's more. Yes.
But there's wait, more. There's more.
Yes. Oh, God. It's not a cleaner that's going to make your whites whiter.
Well,
but it is
in 1990. Was she actually convicted in 95?
95. Yep.
A 16-year-old is convicted to life without the possibility of parole. There have been a lot of changes since then in terms of appropriate sentences for minors.
We'll get to it.
Cruel and unusual punishment. Yep. So I guess I will let you tell that before I interrupt more.
Well, no, it's just you're absolutely right. But it even gets better than that as well.
Okay.
So as a result of her status as a juvenile convicted of murder and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, her case has been the focus of national petitions and judicial reform groups that are advocating not only for a retrial, but like you said, her case helped bring about some of those law changes of cruel and unusual punishment. It was often referenced.
Okay.
Some campaign groups had suggested that Sarah Cruzan was suffering from battered person syndrome, a physical and psychological condition that often results in victims of abuse murdering their abusers 100%. As well. So even take out Sarah's story, which I believe wholeheartedly, by the way, that she was absolutely told, that given this ultimatum by this other man and her boyfriend. Okay. But I also agree with that, with the battered person syndrome. That's Agreed. Possibly why it made it more plausible for her to do and carry out. The National Center for Youth Law has spoken out against the U.S. for the frequency with which it sentences juveniles to life without parole, with Sarah Cruzan often mentioned as an example of the need for greater compassion. During her trial, as I said, her abuse wasn't admitted into evidence and she wasn't allowed to speak of it. 12 years into her sentence, in 2009, she was interviewed by Human Rights Watch, which is a company, where she was finally able to speak about her abuse and as a result received national attention again from individuals and judicial reform groups who advocated for a new trial and a ban on sentences for life without the possibility of parole for juveniles in California.
Do you know at that point in time, this wouldn't even have probably fallen in California's definition of sex trafficking. They weren't even aware of sex trafficking as we know it now. Sex trafficking was sex trafficking in the 90s was like, oh my God, somebody got kidnapped, taken to Mexico and sold into some type of human slavery or bondage. that is not what sex trafficking looks like.
Nope.
Mm-hmm. And we've had cases. I mean, we had the sex trafficker's wife on here to explain what that looked like from her perspective. I bet that was just never even considered as even a potential for her defense. Well, we know it wasn't.
No, it
she wasn't allowed to bring stuff up.
She wasn't.
That was really would have been pertinent to the trial.
And I really think her very kind old school defense attorney, he wasn't there with the research and knowing. He never would have considered this sex trafficking either. Prostitution was what the common term was for this sort of thing, right? It's a different world now. So let me get to even some more good news here. Senator Leland Yee had been fighting for Sarah's release for 11 years, actually, when on January 2nd, 2011, as a result of Senator Leland Yee and media attention, Sarah Cruzan was granted clemency by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnie.
Yep, good old Arnie. He commuted her sentence to 25 years with the possibility of parole.
Okay.
So she remained incarcerated at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. She was literally in one of the most aggressive, violent offender facilities in California.
Yeah, we have Chowchilla stories.
Yes, we do. Now, Governor Schwarzenegger did not free her, but did void her life without the possibility of parole sentence. Then in January 2013, her sentence was reduced to second-degree manslaughter and 19 years, effectively time served, making her eligible for a parole hearing.
Okay.
So she was found suitable.
There was some work put into that, by the way.
Absolutely. And she gets into all of it in the book. That's right. Why I'm just summarizing, you know, for us here. And she was found suitable for parole on June 12th, 2013, and the decision was forwarded to Governor Jerry Brown. On October 25th, 2013, Jerry Brown took no action on the parole board decision, which effectively confirms it, allowing the parole board to proceed with paroling her. On October 31st, 2013, she is paroled from Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla after serving 19 years.
Wow.
Okay. And this is what Senator Leland Yee stated, quote, "Life without parole means absolutely no opportunity for release. It also means minors are often left without access to programs and rehabilitative services while in prison. This sentence was created for the worst of criminals that have no possibility of reform, and it is not a humane way to handle children.
No.
While the crimes they committed caused undeniable suffering, these youth offenders are not the worst of the worst."
They are not.
End quote.
Mm-hmm. 100% agree with that, and the science to back it up is that individuals who are engaged in activities like she is and then who are trafficked, they are at little to no risk to the public if they are rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. That means they're unlikely to reoffend.
Exactly.
Unless they were in the exact same situation as they were before.
Correct.
So the same happens often to women, usually, I'm just going to say women, who are the victims of domestic abuse who end up killing their perpetrator.
Right.
The chances of them being a danger to the public in the future are little to zero. They're mm-hmm. like, they're none. It's really, they killed the person who was causing them a threat in their immediate situation.
Yes. It's a self-defense. If I don't have to defend myself, I'm not going to.
Yeah. The problem is that often they finally come unglued and kill their perpetrator in a moment where they're not actually defending themselves.
Right.
It's because they've been trying to defend themselves for years and then they shoot.
Exactly.
And
they plan carefully for when they can do it without, they have to make sure that they can get it done or their life is going to be at stake. The person is going to kill them, right? Like, it's such a double-edged sword. No pun intended, but.
I think that in and of itself, the best defense was really just the fact that she was a victim and survivor of sex trafficking. I understand where maybe there are some concerns regarding her version of the story where she was told mm-hmm. that she had to kill them. Otherwise, you know, I can see where a prosecutor would look at that and say, dude, that's made up. She's just trying to come up with a defense to, you know, shooting him because she was being trafficked or something like
then
that.
Then she stole his Jaguar and $1,500 from his wallet,
right, which is why leaving her own purse. But again, I don't have a reason to not believe her memoir. Mm-mm, either.
No.
She has nothing to gain or lose from it at this point, other than having her story heard so that other survivors have some, you know, inspiration perhaps.
Right. Well, the fight didn't end there. Sarah Cruzan had been a champion for change and finally was pardoned by Governor Gavin Newsom in July 2022.
Just recently.
Very recently. So it can be off her record as well, which will open up more opportunities for her.
All right.
Too. So, yeah, I just, such an incredible story, such a tragic tale of the way that we used to handle children and women.
Yep.
She describes a lot, you guys, about the court process and just how much she was not informed and did not know, didn't learn until her own trial, because she had no idea. She didn't have proper legal representation there when she was talking to the police, and the police interrupted her. They wouldn't even let her make her statements, let alone look into them appropriately.
You know, on my soapbox, we have a long way to go when it comes to investigating crimes against women and children, and how law enforcement officers approach those. And we know great ones.
Yeah.
But there are also new protocols that can be put in place for every community, so those can be investigated in a particular way. Then there's such a thing as trauma-based prosecution, so that the prosecutor is aware of survivors in the criminal justice system and that they're treated well and informed. Mm-hmm. And then the court system, which is why, you know, I've recently and newly implemented a domestic violence court, but it's really a family violence court, and it deals with any individuals who are the survivors of domestic violence, stalking, sexual abuse, and I think I might be missing one in there as well. And very specifically making sure that survivors and their children are informed of the criminal process, because they're often left out. And where they're left out a lot too, and is in the probation period, where you have individuals who've been sentenced, but then they just don't talk to the families anymore, the survivors, the victims' families. And so this new experiment of mine is keeping them involved in the process throughout the attempt at rehabilitation as well.
Yeah.
And it just, it's come a long way. And I think that people like her continuing to speak out and be a voice.
Yes. And tell the stories the horrors of the past. Whoops. Sorry. I dropped a greegee. Oh,
and
my
you
God.
Scared the dogs.
I scared the dogs too. Sorry about that. It was your little voodoo
I know,
head
I see
that you,
you
gave
you
me.
Stroking him for good juju there. Yeah, it's just how inspirational.
Well, I think the saddest thing for me, besides all of the abuse of this case, is it really hit me hard when there was no one besides herself at 16 years old to be called to her defense, because there was no one in her life who valued her at all. Her mom very much treated her like, look at what you've done. Right? Like, she brought this upon them. You did this, right?
Well, she
like,
was supposed to be there for sexual gratification for men, and instead she killed him.
Yes.
And he was treating her nice, so yes. She should have treated him nice, right?
Yep. And I wanted to end this actually with words from Sarah herself, not from her memoir, but I found an interview that she did for Vogue magazine, and I liked the questions that the reporter asked. And so I wanted to just a couple of them,
oh,
just tell
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
The interviewer said, what do you wish people knew or understood better about trafficking? And you can find the link to this in the show notes so you can read the whole article if you'd like. But she wanted to, you know, this interviewer wanted to know, like, what do you wish people knew and understood about trafficking? And you've actually hit on it already today. She says, Sarah says, there are so many misconceptions. The first being that most people associate child sex trafficking, slavery, and exploitation with countries other than America. But it is a huge crisis here and happened to me on the streets of Los Angeles. People tend to picture unknown traffickers bundling children into white vans and driving off with them.
You got it, girl.
Whereas the vast majority of children are trafficked by people they know. But to me, the most important and painful misunderstanding is that trafficking victims have some sort of choice or agency over what is happening to them. My experience and that of everyone I know and have met in the course of my advocacy work is that trafficking victims are trapped, coerced, and powerless to remove themselves from their situation. They also receive no wages besides perhaps an occasional banknote offered at a whim by their traffickers. So it is the definition of slavery.
Yes.
She's just so poignant.
I love
in her responses. The interviewer said, "What do you think will surprise people about the experience of being in a women's prison when they read your book?" And Sarah said, "When I arrived at Chowchilla, America's largest women's prison, I realized that everyone there had experienced some level of abuse and victimization prior to entering the criminal justice system and were carrying intense levels of grief and pain. Incarceration represents one of the most humiliating quality of life experiences you can go through, and you feel that you have joined a collective of societal discards. Yet it turned into an amazing opportunity as I found that I was able to share a tremendous warmth and tenderness with the other women there, and I made lasting lifelong friendships. We loved and raised one another." That is surprising. Like, I loved hearing that. Then the interviewer said, "You were released after 19 years with help from Human Rights Watch. What was the single best thing about regaining your freedom, and what was the most challenging?" Sarah said the best was the sky.
Really?
Getting to see the sky in its entirety again.
That's sad.
Yeah. The most challenging.
Like, just so profound.
Right? The simplest thing that we take for granted every damn day, you guys.
Yeah.
That we can see all the sky at any time that we want. Unless you live in the city. I hear it's smaller there.
I'm right.
Most challenging for her was decision-making on every level. After 19 years of having my choices controlled and limited from what time to get up to what to eat, this continues to be overwhelming. That is something I had never considered, Megan, about being released.
Yeah.
You do have, now you have autonomy. What do you do with it? What do you do with your free will now?
Well, that's why we have a lot of reoffenders and individuals who really feel more comfortable in lockup. And we also have come a long way, at least in terms of during the time frame that she was recently released, you know, in terms of prisoner reentry.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of prisoner reentry programs now that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm.
But this is why it's needed.
It is, because of just that psychology behind it.
Yeah.
And again, we have to remember, unlike maybe other people who have spent time in and out of prison when they're doing their prisoner reentry, this is a child.
Yeah.
She was sent to prison as a child. Her brain wasn't done growing until she was 10 to 11 years into her sentence, guys.
Correct.
This is a child whose brain was still developing, let me say it again, for about the first decade of her imprisonment.
Yep, exactly.
That's where we are.
So, of course, she gets overwhelmed by things like, what would you like for breakfast? What do you want for lunch? What do you want for dinner?
What are you serving me on a tray?
Exactly.
I don't know.
What do you mean I get to make those choices? What do you want to wear tomorrow?
The anxiety.
No, she said it still continues in 2000. I think this article was 2022 or something like that, or 23. It continues to be overwhelming for her. And I can absolutely see why.
Yeah.
It would be so hard to deprogram from. I wanted to end on this. The question was, what is your greatest hope for your book? And Sarah said that it will inspire empathy for victims of trafficking and exploitation and help young people faced with these circumstances encounter greater understanding. By describing my experiences as a trafficking survivor, inadequately treated by our criminal justice system, I am hoping to make a contribution to conversations that will help propel legal reform and encourage us to better serve and protect children in danger. I love her.
She's great.
Yeah.
What a great read. Tell us the name of the book again.
It is, and it's going to be in the show notes as well, I Cried to Dream Again, Trafficking, Murder, and Deliverance, a Memoir by Sarah Cruzan, and that is S-A-R-A-K-R-U-Z-A-N, with Corey Thomas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want me to bathe you?
Please, my dear friend Megan.
My God, bathe me,
God, I'm ripping my clothes off now. Give me a bath.
All right. Stolen from Facebook.
By the way, just kidding. I am still
She's
fully
totally
clothed.
Fully clothed. We both are. I'm sorry, gentlemen. So this is from a Jay Leno from a Tonight Show episode. Okay.
Okay.
So Jay Leno went into the audience to find the most embarrassing first date that a woman ever had.
Oh, God.
The winner described her worst first date experience. There was absolutely no question as to why her tale took the prize. She said, it was midwinter, snowing, and quite cold. And the guy had taken her skiing in the mountains outside Salt Lake City, Utah. It was a day trip, no overnight.
Okay.
They were strangers after all and had never met before. The outing was fun but relatively uneventful until they were headed home late that afternoon. They were driving back down the mountain when she gradually began to realize that she should not have had that extra latte.
Oh,
they were about a half an hour away from anywhere with a restroom and in the middle of nowhere. Her companion suggested that she try to hold it, which she did for a while. Unfortunately, because of the heavy snow going on, there came a point where she told him they had to stop and let her go beside the road, or it was going to be in the front seat of the car.
Yeah.
They stopped and she quickly crawled out beside the car, yanked her pants down, and started peeing. In the deep snow, she didn't have good footing. So she let her butt rest against the rear fender to steady herself. Her companion stood on the side of the car watching for traffic and indeed was a real gentleman and refrained from peeking. All she could think about was the relief she felt despite the rather embarrassing nature of the situation. Upon finishing, however, she soon became aware of another sensation. As she bent to pull up her pants, she discovered that her buttocks were firmly glued against the car's fender.
That's where I thought we were going with this.
Thoughts of tongues frozen to poles immediately came to mind as she attempted to disengage her flesh from the icy metal.
Oh, ouch.
It was quickly apparent that she had a brand new problem due to the extreme cold, negative temperatures. Horrified by her plight and yet aware of the humor of the moment, she answered her date's concerns about what is taking so long with a reply that she was indeed freezing her butt off.
I'm stuck
and
to
in
your
need
car.
Of some assistance. He came around the car, and as she tried to cover herself with a sweater,
oh my God.
And then as she looked imploringly into his eyes, he burst out laughing. She too got the giggles, and when they finally managed to compose themselves, they assessed her dilemma. Obviously, as hysterical as this was, they were faced with a real problem.
Yeah.
Both agreed it would take something hot to free her chilly cheeks.
Oh my God. Oh
from
no.
From the grip.
No.
Of the icy metal.
Does he pee on her?
Thinking about what had gotten her into the predicament in the first place, both quickly realized there was only one way to get her free. So as she looked the other way, her first time date proceeded to unzip his pants and pee her butt off the fender.
Oh my God.
As the audience at the Tonight Show screamed in laughter, she took the Tonight Show prize hands down, or perhaps that should be pants down. Jay Leno's comment, this gives a whole new meaning to being pissed off. Oh, and how did her first date turn out? He became her husband, and sitting next to her on the Leno show.
Thank God, because you got to marry the person who you let pee on your arse.
On the first date.
Yeah. Yeah, because otherwise it's just some random dude that peed on you that one time.
Yeah, and so, that's a whole different story, and you don't tell your kids about it.
You don't. So it's so much better when you can marry that person.
Honey, remember that time you pissed on my ass?
Right. Oh my God. That is also, I mean, how chivalrous, by the way, kind of reminds me of the Friends episode when Monica gets stung by the jellyfish.
Which apparently doesn't really work, you guys.
Apparently not, but it was a really funny episode. Yeah. You
Who's
know?
Willing to pee on me?
Yes.
All right, I'll do it.
I will pee on any one of my friends in distress.
Thank you.
This is a better example of why one might have to pee on someone, by the way. I would save you from being stuck to a bumper
any
day.
Can you imagine how painful that is?
No. No, your whole arsh.
Your whole arsh.
And I'm just picturing, like, what if he took off, she's just still stuck there. Like,
just like the dog from National Lampoon.
Yeah.
Little feller probably kept up for a couple miles or so.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
That was lovely.
It gave me a giggle.
Yeah, me too. Thank you all so much for supporting our podcast by listening. If you would like to binge hundreds of extra episode exclusive content, go ahead and click in the show notes our Patreon link. You can join. We're there. They get several episodes a month of bonus content. So feel free to do that. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening. We hope that you keep it curious.
And until next time, keep listening.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.